The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 21, 2017. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. It's good to see you all, particularly on this gloomy day, this weather. Anyway, glad to see you all here. Because this isn't a regularly scheduled meeting, I didn't really prepare anything, though I could talk. I always have a few things in the back of my mind. But I thought this might be a good opportunity. If you have some questions, maybe we can just have some Q&A this morning. We haven't done that in a while. So if any of you have any questions or anything you'd like to discuss about our teachings, the practice.
We think we have it all down.
You have it all down. Good. All right. Ellen.
Okay. I want to hear again about the role of a teacher in Zen.
The role of a teacher.
Yes. And also the role of the student in relation to the teacher. Is that a question?
Well, it sounds like a question. What you said you want to hear this again. What have you heard before?
Well, I asked this question about 2 years ago when I first started coming. Mm-hmm. And Norm answered it. And it was a good answer. He talked about pointing. The teacher's role is pointing. Mm-hmm. And not becoming attached to the teacher.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of the...
Or to anything. But certainly not the teacher. Yeah. Yeah, well, what we call the teacher, we just step back for a minute and look at the overall situation that we as human beings find ourselves in. And here we are. At some point, we realize we're in this world. We're in this big world. Maybe a very early age or whatever, but here we are. And, of course, there's older people around. They're pointing out various things to us, things that are helpful for us, perhaps. Also, maybe some things that aren't so helpful. We learn this along the way as well. But if we get to a point in our life where we really want to settle down and to understand just what is going on here, and what is human life? How might we ought to live this life? Is there some particular way to live it that maybe will free us from a lot of confusion and pain and suffering and this sort of thing? A lot of perhaps some big questions here, big existential type questions, as well as just practical questions. How to get along from day to day without too much difficulty and confusion. So these are the kind of questions that would come up. And maybe, well, almost certainly, we could probably use a little help along the lines here. And, of course, we might explore and try out different things. There's plenty of occasion where there's people out there who they're carrying their flag, their banner, they have their teaching. And whether it's academic or civic or militaristic or religious or whatever it might be, there's certainly all of these things that are out there. In fact, this reminds me of the question that the Buddha received. And the Buddha lived at a time when there was a great deal of intellectual, spiritual, philosophical ferment. This was during the axial age, as it is now called, when a lot of things in the world were really being stirred up in many cultures around the world. You know, there's Taoism in China and in India. Many things were coming about at that time. And, of course, in the Middle East, a great deal of ferment there. And soon Christianity would come out of that. So it was at a time in the world where many people were searching and digging and looking. Here we are in India, where somebody was asking the Buddha about this, and many teachers about teaching this and that and the next thing. What was on everybody's lips at that time was this term, right view. And this person, so this questioner was asking the Buddha, this person says, this is right view, and then another person says, this is right view, and this is right view. And he said, well, they can't all be the right view, because some of these were conflicting with others. So how might one, the question then was, so how might one understand right view, or is there such a thing as right view? And then the Buddha pointed out that, this is a very good question. You've raised a question in an area of doubt, he says. There's something very doubtful in this situation. Here we are, as human beings, we end up in this world with a human mind where we can ask questions, and we might just busy ourselves with trivial things or everyday things and things of this sort. We don't dig deeply into any deep question we might have, and maybe these questions, they might be there, but they're not on the surface for you. And that's fine. And so you live your life, but it might be best, again, to reflect on your life a little bit so that you can live it in such a way that where it isn't too vexing or troublesome for you or for others. But when we get into a place where we might really start to ask, you know, some deeper questions about all of this. And now, where do we turn to? This person says this thing, and the next person says another thing, and another thing, and another thing. So this is the question that was put then to the Buddha. And he congratulated the person on, yeah, this is a very good question. So now what are we going to do about it? Anyway, this is the kind of thing we might come to, where we can really settle down and just look at that question. Usually we're preoccupied with finding an answer. That's where these different views come from. Well, here's the answer to this one. We have this view, we take this view, we take that view. But the Buddha pointed out that in this world of ferment, and where so many things are being offered or could be offered, things not invented now, that somebody might come up with this idea or that idea still in the future, and now another view here, another view there. This is the ongoing problem that we as human beings have. It's embedded in so many aspects of our lives. So how do we deal with this? And do you need a teacher? And if so, well, who? Who would you turn to when you have all these vexing questions? So, and then under these circumstances, do you need a teacher? Well, it would be very helpful. But just in that person asking the Buddha this question, thinking perhaps that the Buddha maybe is a wise person, many people see him as their teacher, this sort of thing. Of course, the Buddha said, well, don't believe me just because other people might or do it, or they come to me or they look to me as their teacher. For everyone, what he pointed out is see and know for yourself. See the truth. Know this for yourself. But again, how do you find that? And would you have ever thought of that for yourself if it weren't for this person here, who we now refer to as the Buddha, pointed that out? So is it helpful that you have that someone else out there, like the Buddha in this case? Yeah, that is helpful for us. But there's something about that little exchange there. There was nothing in the exchange between the Buddha and that person where the Buddha was trying to claim that person, trying to control that person, handing the person some kind of a graspable answer here. This is the truth. This is what you should believe. This is what you should think. This is what you should do. He didn't do it. He didn't work in this way. Because as the Buddha pointed out, with all of these grasp views, these different views that were being spouted by various people saying, this is right view and this is right, I have right view. The next person says, I have right view. And many of these views, well, sooner or later, any one of them is going to conflict with some of the others, if not all of them. So the Buddha did something else. But he also pointed that amongst all these views that people hang on to, beliefs in that about one thing or another, they have these characteristics of, they all boil down to basically two views. One's called eternalism, in other words, nihilism. But, you know, you just say is or is not, existence or non-existence, or permanence and impermanence. So they basically reduce to two. And then the Buddha also pointed out this, to hang on to any of these things, any of the kinds of things that people were throwing out there, whoever they are. It doesn't have to be even in India there, but wherever they're speaking, in China or the Middle East or anywhere, even here in the Americas, no doubt. Of course, they didn't know about these lands at that time, nor were they called America, but you know what I mean. Because this is universal, what he's drawing our attention to here. That it is in the grasping first of all, he points out that all of these views reduce to these two extremes, basically. And then he's also pointing out that to grasp at either of these extremes is deadly, is a mistake. Well, is it or isn't it? It is if you want to wake up. And this is what concerned the Buddha, because he knew that the release from suffering is only going to be there if we wake up. But he also knew that this isn't something you can wrap into a package and then hand it to somebody and say, hey, you know, believe this. Trust this. Hang on to this. That is the chronic problem. But there is something here that he could point out. And he did. About what our situation is. Just to really clarify the situation. It's universal. I mean, we could talk about it in these terms and those terms and that sort of thing. Different cultural views that play into all of these, you know, various views and things. But it's this overall situation. It just looks the same wherever you go. This is what, as human beings, because we have these wonderful human minds where we can abstract the world in our minds, conceptualize it, and wonder about various things, and we're always reaching for one thing or another, the answer to these things. This is our problem. This is our situation. It's wonderful that we have such a good, and we can use this capacity that we have in so many wonderful ways, and yet it's almost like a curse for us human beings. Because it gets us into such deep and vexing trouble. If we begin to ask these deeper questions, as I said before, you can just kind of stay on the surface there and don't worry about it, and maybe you're fine. Maybe, maybe not. Because sooner or later, you're very likely to sink into this a little bit, and now you're going to be vexed. And at this point, of course, we might go to this person or that person, and they're offering something, and this person's offering something, and maybe they believe it. Maybe, you know, maybe they're also a charlatan. They're just going to use you. Could be any number of things going on there. But the thing is that you yourself, apart from the Buddha or anyone else, you have this vexing problem. We all do. Okay, so this is how the Buddha laid it out. This is how he pointed to it. This is how we are. I mean, this is our situation. And now, do you need a teacher in these circumstances? Well, I wouldn't grasp at anything here. This kind of teaching, this kind of practice is always reminding us of just watch your mind. Don't grasp at anything. Notice when you're doing this. You can see the situation, but you need to have a settled mind. And you have to recognize when this grasping mind is taking place. And it might very well be necessary for somebody who maybe we might want to refer to as a teacher. Though, of course, all these various people, and so many of them holding various views, also are called teachers. And they seem to be teaching. Right? But someone like the Buddha we might refer to as a teacher because they're teaching us, they're pointing out something to us here. And is that required? Do you have to have, because that's I think what you're asking me. Is that necessary? Well, actually, it's not absolutely necessary. It is possible just to wake up spontaneously without the guidance of somebody else who maybe has worked through all of this and still left standing without being too confused or tossed away or gripped by something or is gripping something. But it's very unlikely for that. Had I myself, just speaking for myself, had I not come upon these teachings at some point in this practice, this way of life, I don't think I would understand what I understand about this now. But more than that, yeah, I mean, I've read books, I've encountered various people, taught me various things here and there along the way, but it was until I finally met my teacher, Gotagiri Roshi, and it's not like he would be the only possibility there, but in my case, that's who it was. Without his help, which really wasn't anything terribly overt or anything of this sort, he wasn't the sort who would get in and just try to, he would just present things, show us things. And he would practice day after day. And on occasion, I had opportunities to present to him my confused ideas about one thing or another, though at the time, in many cases, I didn't particularly think that my ideas were confused or anything. But in various subtle ways, he was able to, not overtly, not in any way, but he was able to help me see. There's certain things I was hanging on to that I wasn't even aware that I was hanging on to. And learn to let that go. I don't think I would have understood this without that kind of help. But never, and this is what I think you can look for in a teacher, never did I ever get the impression from him that he expected me to follow him or to believe something he was handing me or anything of this sort. It was almost like he was indifferent to me. That's what it kind of felt like for a long time at first. Later I began to realize that that really wasn't the case at all. I think deep in his heart he was very interested, for all of us, that we would wake up. But the person that we might call a teacher at this point, they can only do so much. In the end, it was for me, it is for all of us, each of us, to take care of this ourselves. But to find somebody like this, they don't have an agenda. They're not trying to control you, manipulate you, steer you in some way. But who's constantly turning your attention to notice the kind of contradictions and confusions that are embraced by you within your own mind, and, you know, in very tacit and quiet and unspoken ways that you might not even really be aware of yourself. So this is very helpful for us. So do we need a teacher or not? But that's the situation. I don't want to say, I think so, probably, if you're lucky enough to find one. But it's not absolutely required. But the danger there is, it's so easy for any of us to think, okay, I got it now, this is it. But I'll tell you right now, if you discover that when you think you have the answer to something, and you're gripping something, and you don't understand yet, you don't have that. You don't have what it is you think you have. What it is that we wake up to and realize isn't something like that at all. You can't identify with it. You can't use it, you know, to bring about what other, what more do you, if this is it, what are you doing with that? So there's a lot of subtlety here, and it's easy to get sidetracked and confused. But I would say, yeah, it would be, you know, for all practical purposes, yeah, I think you need a teacher. Again, I realized, I certainly did. I'm very grateful for that. But I really don't want to make it quite so emphatic as that. Really, what I'm interested in, not just in this question, but in virtually everything that I present here and talk about, I really don't want to be too specific about anything, because our tendency now then is to grasp something. If I make it too tightly focused here, it becomes pretty easily grasped. And I also know that, well, that's a trap. That's the continuation of our confusion. And even though, while we're still confused, we think we need something to hang on to, if you finally wake up to the fact that actually, no, you don't, you realize how much freedom there is when you don't fall into that. But of course, you really need to be free of this. And if you feel like, well, no, I am free of this because I have it. I'm afraid you're still confused at that point. If you have any sense of yourself walking away with some kind of understanding about this, you're still confused. And you're very likely, at best, to end up in a place like that. It's kind of a pratheka area, if you don't have a teacher. On the other hand, if you go seeking for a teacher, very good chance you can end up with one who doesn't really understand this. So there you are. But the other thing you can rely on, and this is what the Buddha said, be a light unto yourself. You know. And when you're interacting with someone else, you can tell. But whoever it is, I wouldn't reject them or throw them away. You don't have to embrace what it is that they're doing or this sort of thing. But don't just stop playing that game. Oh yeah, here's a good one here. That's no. Just stop all this nonsense. The whole world is like this. It's muddy water. What are you doing? Stop playing that game. Wake up. But in the end, this is what you're going to have to do. This. But there are some people we can run into that can really help us with this, who aren't confused about this, and so they can help us. But they won't be heavy-handed in any way whatsoever. So I don't know, did I help you there, Alan? Yeah. Anything else? Yeah, Peter.
Sometimes the stress that if you have preferences that lead you entangled you in things, can you talk a little bit about how avoiding preferences is compatible with compassion?
Yeah, don't try to avoid preferences. Oh. That doesn't help. if it's an intentional avoidance, you're creating something again. This is what we need to start to recognize when we're creating something, we're condensing something into something, and now we're going to react to that. And, you know, just stop all this. That's what I was saying there too before. Here we are in muddy water. Just stop playing that game. Just see that for what it is and recognize in yourself your mind is leaning toward this and away from that. Just realize what's going on there and see if you can let that go. So that's what I would say about preference. But so what were you saying then?
But for a wise man who says he had no preferences, mm-hmm. and how does that relate to the idea of combine with compassion?
Well, what is it to be without preference? What would that be? That would be, well, I'll tell you, it's if there's you as a separate ego, separate self here, as we normally see ourselves, and in any given moment we can always do that. Here I am, and then there's this other stuff out there. Some of those things out there I kind of like. I prefer that over this, you know, and that kind of stuff. So I'm moving in that direction, away from that. And this is what I refer to when Buddhism, plain and simple, this is what I was talking about, with a leaning mind. You know, your mind is leaning and that way it's inclined toward this and away from that. This is what you want to be watching for. I also pointed out there, don't try to straighten up your mind then. That's more preference. Just see what is going on here. Feel the feelings of your heart and your mind. And realize where you are with this. And then also understand what that is. It's being pulled around in these ways. And if you can wake up to this, if you can understand this, now you're beginning to see things in terms of whole mind, or true mind, or mind with a capital M. It's not just your small egoistic mind that is at play here. But you're actually seeing. Well, and this is an awakened mind sees in just this way. And you can begin to act in a way that is acting out of a whole mind. Okay, well, at that point, then, this is absolutely compatible, what can I say, synonymous with compassion. It is also wisdom in seeing in this way. And then the actions that might come with a mind that is seeing like this, these are actions of that we can call compassion, karuna. So we have prajna and karuna, and but they're working together. Yeah.
If you have a preference, actually, that's somewhere that's going to conjure enmity, and that would make compassion possible. If you're open to everything, then compassion is natural.
Yes, well, when you're saying if you're open to everything, I'm not quite sure how you mean that.
Without preference.
Without preference, okay. Because it isn't necessarily approving of everything or something like this. But what we wake up to is. Okay, another, actually this is something I might talk about it next Sunday. I'm scheduled to talk that one, so I almost thought of talking about it today, but because it's kind of coming up now. In fact, our president over there in Saudi Arabia right now is talking about good and evil, and our Secretary of State too was talking about this. This is the thing of our time, good against evil. So I think I'm going to say a little bit about this. But to get back to where we were, part of what makes what we were talking about here just before I kind of sidetracked it a little bit is that we generally are very confused about this matter of good and evil. It's very dualistic. You know, and of course, the good is good. I like this. I want to go toward that. Evil, oh-ish, you know. Except sometimes maybe we kind of identify, okay, I know I'm a rat and I'm no good guy, but doggone it, you know, I just want to make a bunch of money or whatever else, or maybe you're just not too concerned about such things and that sort of thing. But again, this is the epitome of a lunging mind, you know, a grasping mind, a leaning mind, to be viewing the world in this way. And for most of us, and particularly raised in our culture here, it's kind of spread worldwide now, this kind of thinking in terms of good and evil, good and bad. The point of view of the wise Chinese farmer, you know, who can say what's good or bad? You know, and the thing about he has a little bit of misfortune that turns out to be kind of fortunate, which turns out to be kind of misfortune, you know, on and on. Well, who can say? But in that kind of a view, we're really looking at it in terms of the whole. And in terms of the whole, if our mind can really get into this space, what does it even mean to lean now? To show a preference. But the actions that come out of this kind of understanding, once again, are, this is what we would call compassion. When we're locked back down into kind of an ordinary understanding, you know, here I am and I see that suffering person over there, and I feel for them, and I want to help them, you know, to heal their wounds, to feed them if they're hungry, all that sort of thing. And then we think, well, this is compassion. Yes, of course, this is compassion. And we can say, and that's good. Yes, I would agree, that's good. And we should act that way. Well, I'm not so sure if I'd go with the word should, but yeah, please do. Help. If you see that, help them if you can. Yes, of course. But what do we need to be looking at in this picture? And I'll tell you, what I'm seeing in this picture, whenever I find myself getting too caught up in the more dense and delineated thing here, whatever it might be, good, evil, whatever else, I want to catch myself before I go too far with this and stand back and look at this. What is helpful for us in terms of awakening, in terms of finally seeing what our situation is and how to deal with it, is to pull back into the whole here. Why then would we say, well, this is good or better, you know, that you actually, you know, help people who are suffering in one way or another, if you can alleviate their pain and suffering? Well, you don't have to see it in terms of good and evil. And one of the reasons for this is because other people, they might think, well, you know, that person is really a bad person, and you shouldn't be helping them. And you know, and here we are like this. We have people flying planes in the buildings who, you know, many of us are just horrified by that, and yet they might think they're doing something good. And like the wise Chinese farmer, who can say what's good? But so it isn't helpful to see things in those terms, but that's usually where our mind is coming from. But for the awakened, what they're looking at is the whole. And now we're talking about true compassion. True compassion, that, you know, to act in this way. But how is this person now acting? Whether it's to help that poor person who's hungry and suffering or injured or whatever. It could be that, well, here's me and I want to help you. Yeah, and as I said, oh, sure, we could say that's good. Yeah, that would be very good. But why? In the larger picture, the awakened are always turning their attention toward the whole and to bring us back into that. And why? So that the mind, a mind like this, settles down. It's a mind of true compassion and wisdom, and it is settled. We talk about in our practice the most refined and settled practice that we do in the Zazen. We call it Shikan Taza. What I'm pointing out now is the she in the Shikan Taza. It is settledness. It is tranquility. It is calmness. And it is a mind like this. And in the Shikan then is the seeing of what the situation is. Taha is to hit that just so, and za means sitting. So that's our Zazen. It's like this. But that she part, this is what is so important. And to the extent that, say, if you're still acting out of yourself, out of your ego, yeah, and you are helping that person, and your heart's going out to the, of course, I mean, that's good. I mean, I'm not going to say that's bad. But it could be involved with look at these other evil people over here who created this situation, and I'm angry at them. There could be all kinds of other confusion still bound up in that. And that's the problem. And unless we see that and break out of that, we will perpetuate this kind of problem and difficulty for ourselves around the world. And now we go to the Middle East, and we're talking about in terms of good and evil. We got to do something about this. And here we go again.
So you say that even if your health can be a kind of narrow grasping, and the grasping itself is precludes compassion. You honed in too tightly, and therefore you're splitting things up, and that makes it very difficult to be compassionate because you're splitting the wrong mind now.
Mm-hmm. Well, we might still exhibit compassion in a conventional way, which is, I'm not going to argue against that. All I'm saying is that this is still a problem here. And this isn't what is meant by karuna, or compassion, the compassion that comes with wisdom, prajna. So it's of a different sort altogether. But if we were to see things in those terms, as long as we're seeing things in those terms, you're not going to be caught in those things. If we slip off and we start to get caught, favoring this a little bit, trying to drive this through, shutting them down a little bit because they're so bad, you know, when we're starting to take this kind of approach again, we're back to ordinary mind. And in the end, it's just to perpetuate the human sorrow. And there's no end to that. The wise Chinese farmer, back and forth, and who can say? But the wise Chinese farmer, he's not caught in it. The neighbor was, who kept saying, well, it's great, that, no, it's bad, and it's great. But the farmer, he wasn't pulled by that. And so that's the difference here. So just to put it into a nutshell, rather than to see things as good and evil pitted against each other, which in the end isn't very healthy. You know, do we say, no, that isn't good? Whatever. It's not true good, perhaps we could say. But there's that. Or we can see things in terms of wholeness and the unwhole, where we're acting out of the part, out of the self, the ego. And that's the difference. And the awakened are all in this moment, if one is awake, you're ever mindful in that moment of the whole, of totality. You're seeing things in these terms. And you see your little self forming out of this and starting to lean this way or that, or reaching for this or that, even though, yes, you have a good heart, all of this or anything, but you're already in trouble. And so when we see ourselves slipping off in this way, just see if you can pull yourself back. And what are we looking for? You're just looking for this leaning in your own heart. And we can get better skilled at noticing that and the subtlety with which those kinds of things rear up and then they take us away. And it's not a matter that you bring this to a point where now you can operate this perfectly. I really don't think it's humanly possible, but of course I don't know for sure. I know I can't do that. I'm not sure if anybody could. But that's not the point either. Again, we have this tendency to go to one extreme or the other. Well, then it must be that you get to, so you're forever pure. You're a Buddha on the dime, perfectly, endlessly. But no, I don't think that. But we can become more and more skilled at noticing this. But it's the noticing is going on in your own heart and mind. Our tendency is to always be looking out there. But here's where you need. You can't do anything about that. Look at your own heart and mind, and start to recognize what it is you need to be looking for. And don't judge. That's more of the same gripping kind of stuff. You're even your own self. But see this and start to recognize this is pain and confusion and heartache and suffering, and it's a perpetuation of the cries of the world. This isn't. And so just be watching that and looking for that. So, yeah. Anything else? Okay, well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.